Hi, and welcome to the latest in this series of podcast interviews with leading fundraising professionals. I'm joined today by Charlie Hume from Donor Voice. Welcome, Charlie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you work for Donor Voice. I wonder, could you just say a little bit about Donor Voice's work and sort of what the sort of broad area of retention is all about?
Okay, so Donor Voice was set up back in 2011. I guess most people will be familiar with Roger Craver, the Agitator.
Indeed, yeah.
And he put together a book actually this year, which is almost kind of a history of where Donor Voice came from. But in a nutshell, Roger is almost like the godfather of fundraising.
Sure.
You know, he's been doing this since before most of us were born. And he set out on almost an odyssey, you know, a few years ago to say, why is it that we lose so many donors?
Yeah.
I was speaking to someone, the well-known fundraising director today, who was saying the last 8 years, they have had only 7 months where they've had more donors coming in than going out.
So this is the leaky bucket.
Yeah, but so this is, in other words, you could say for the last 8 years, 93% of the time, they've been losing more than they've been gaining.
Yeah,
okay? And that's not uncommon.
Yeah.
Why is that? Why the hell would that be? It was the unanswerable question. I think there was a time and a place long before, you know, you and I came on the scene, where you could almost afford to ignore that fact because people were coming on. It doesn't happen anymore. So Roger set out to try and crack that code, and he hired in a guy from the commercial sector, Kevin Shulman, who far and away the authority on this subject.
Sure.
To kind of test and validate this work that Kevin had been doing in the commercial world for a long time on how do corporates keep their customers.
Yeah.
And see if it could be applied in the charity world, and of course it can. So yeah. They tested this a commitment modelling, which I'll kind of get into what commitment means a little later on. But a commitment modelling process with 250 plus charities in the UK, Australia, United States, Canada, and parts of Europe, yes. Just to see do the same methodologies apply, and of course they do, because at the end of the day, people are people. Mm-hmm. You don't stop doing something you want.
The psychology is
you don't stop buying product or service you want. So why should we accept, you know, horrendous attrition, you know, 7 out of 10 donors, whatever it is, leaving us as normal? Yeah. That's not normal.
And that would be unacceptable in the commercial world. If you're running a business.
Yeah, business. Right. How long would you stay in business if you did that for? I mean, how many businesses would say it's okay for the last 8 years that 93% we're losing more than we're getting?
Mm.
You just wouldn't keep your job. The company. George Smith wrote this in his book 20 odd years ago, that any company that lost, that had more former customers than current, would go out of business.
And there's academic work as well. So Adrian Sargent's written a lot about this. So this is not—it's not news, is it? We've known a lot of this stuff.
This is not news. Adrian Sargent wrote about this stuff. What was it? 10+ years ago, since his Building Donor Loyalty came out. Ken Burnett
relationship.
That's 21 years ago now. So it's the theory has always been there, and then Adrian kind of took theory into, well, actually, this is this is very real. The concept that a 10%. Increase in loyalty would lead to a 200% increase in lifetime value. It's there.
Yeah.
We part of the work that Roger and Kevin did in this retention fundraising book that's just come out was to kind of test the difference in lifetime value between someone, a donor with low commitment and high commitment. And on average, internationally, there's a 131% difference between the low, in terms of lifetime value, between a low committed donor and a high committed donor.
Right.
So someone with a commitment score, again, I'll come to commitment scores, but someone with a low commitment score compared to a high commitment score, 131% difference in lifetime value that's sitting on every house file now.
Yeah.
Because the bottom line is people don't know who their low and who their high commitment people are. They've no idea who that is.
Yeah.
And even if they uncovered them, they still have no idea what to say to them.
Right. Mm. So Donor Voice is kind of working, producing products and working with charities at this point to try to sort of focus them really and allow them to understand who are the most, where's the affinity, where's the commitment, where's the attachment, and that's what.
But it's beyond the who. I think our sector's challenge has been it's obsessed with who. you know, it's all about segmentation and who's in, who's out, and who should we be focusing on, blah, 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 and all of that. Let's say that you answered that question definitively, and you now could look at your house file and say, okay, there's the who, those are the people, we need to focus on them. You still wouldn't be able to answer the real question, which is, what do I need to say to them? What am I going to do with them? Why are they loyal? Sure. Because I don't actually know.
Yes.
You know, it just turns out that they are loyal almost by default.
Sure.
So what's driving that, and what do I need to say to do that? So that's what Donor Voice is really in the business of, uncovering the what. You know,
right. So
looking at what it is that causes that loyalty, and then mapping out a strategy that make sure you deliver that over time to the detriment of all the other things that are going on that crowd that out.
Okay, and so we'll touch, because this series is aimed at people who do roles in the areas of prospect research, which is what I do, and also insights. So trying to use quantitative and qualitative methods to understand motivation, but also the kind of segmentation side of things as well that we just talked about. So we'll just look at that a little bit. Sort of in more detail, because Donor Voice has sort of talked about, and yourself and Kevin have talked a bit in the past about sort of how this actually happens. You mentioned lifetime value, and that's a really key measure, isn't it, to be used. Do you think that's a really central measure for people to be aware of in that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we are, one of the things that cuts us off from ever growing is the obsessive need for short-term return. Mm. You know, I mean, every campaign it's all about year one ROI, and we need to see a return on investment immediately. If you're really ambitious, it's maybe 3 years out, but it's incredibly short metric. Yeah, yeah. So that's what we're focused on, you know. So it basically cuts us off from being able to grow or do anything. Amazon, it took 6 years before they turned a profit.
And we know with supporters that there's an investment up front to recruit supporters, and that's going to be recouped over a period of time.
Yeah.
So it doesn't, you know, the research we were talking about before, you don't have to be academic to understand that that's a difficult equation to square that. So you've got to make this investment. Somebody cancels, doesn't make a gift, makes one gift or two gifts, then that's not going to work out as a business model, I think. But that's the prevailing view.
But that's the prevailing view, but because we're so short-term, because I think somewhere along the line, fundraising has become almost 100% synonymous with acquisition. That I think any outsider coming into our sector, judging us on our actions and looking at the things we do, would say fundraising is all about acquisition.
How did that come to be? Let me press you on that. How did this focus on acquisition?
Wasn't there, but
how would you say that came about?
I think there was like I said earlier on, there was a time and a place when we could do that, and we could get away with it, is the wrong phrase, but when there were more people out there, it was, I don't say it was ever easy, but it was certainly easier than it was today.
Okay.
That, you know, that we were fishing in a much larger pond than we are today.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's, what is it in the UK, it's like 180,000 charities now?
Yeah, it's 160-odd.
And I heard, I don't know if it's either 130 a week or 130 a month new charities coming in.
Everyone
is racing in, you know. The donor pool is not growing. The amount that we're giving, individual giving, has not grown now for a decade. The UK public spends or donates as much to charity as it spends on cheese. This is literally true.
Yeah.
You know, so either, you know, we think they like cheese as much as they like, you know, us to solve our mission, or there's something badly wrong with the way we're going about articulating it.
Yeah, and that's an interesting one. Do you see then this idea of retaining and building relationships as a way to grow that pie?
Yeah.
Because that's a real challenge. And previous people in this series have spoken about this. Charities know that the average supporter has a profile, tends to be older, possibly religious, often female. Now, we need, as a sector, we need to be aware that these people aren't going to be around forever, and we need to adjust accordingly. Do you see retention as a kind of way to address that?
Well, retention is ultimately about, you can't, acquisition has never been this difficult or this expensive.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And in the meantime, there is massive potential to be unlocked on the current files at the moment.
Yeah.
Everyone's chasing the kind of mystical, new, younger, hip, trendy donor who doesn't seem to have shown up yet. You know, in the meantime, you have all these people
yeah.
who are showing up to give us money,
mm-hmm.
and the way we treat them, I mean, you know, in terms of the service that, or the respect that we give these people, really, is just, it's sadly lacking. I'm trying not to say so too rude.
Yeah.
It's lacking.
You know? Really? So that's, and so in your mind, what does that make the challenge then? Is that all about service? Is it all about taking care of it, getting these thank you letters out really quickly, thinking about the comms and structuring it? Is that yeah. key? Is that the key?
Service, if we could move the mindset from seeing donor service as a cost center rather than a profit center. Kind of park the thank you comms just for a moment, but I mean, in terms of, you can't make any transaction in the commercial world these days without being asked for feedback. You know, mm-hmm. whatever you do, you know, whether it's, you know, buying an airline ticket, down to the point last week, literally my local curry house is asking me for feedback. And I'm not talking about a chain here, I'm talking about the local curry house is ringing me up asking for feedback
right.
tied to, you know, the product they've just given me.
Your experience,
yeah. Yeah, because, you know, they know, the commercial world knows that 50% of the repurchase decision is tied to service.
Mm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
We don't do that. In the commercial world, 35% of their outbound calling is tied to service. How did we do?
How do we do? Yeah. Tell us. Give us
in
that
this answer. Sector, it's less than 1%.
Right.
We're assigning zero value to any of that. You know, there's a whole industry, set up in the commercial world for soliciting customer feedback
mm-hmm.
that doesn't bother trying to sell into this sector because there isn't any demand here.
And is that because of the reasons you talked about before? Because, you know, 10, 20 years ago, whenever it was, that acquisition came to the fore and individual giving became a huge industry.
Yeah.
Is this a hangover from that point then? And
well, I think it is. I think bad practices get passed off as, you know, or bad habits rather get passed off as best practice.
Mm.
And it's and mm-hmm. weird kind of reason. No matter how new and funky the channel gets, we're still doing the same things we always did. And when you get right down to it, it doesn't matter how sophisticated the method of communication is, we're still ultimately just rattling a tin.
Yeah. You know,
we're not taking it to another level to how did we do there? How could we improve this experience for you?
Yeah.
Were we to do that, we would really stand out, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's very difficult for a donor to distinguish. I mean, you think how commoditized fundraising has got. If you were to lay out five fundraising packs now from five international development charities and blur the logo out, you know, and read the first few paragraphs, you wouldn't have a clue.
And that's key, isn't it? Because support at the amount of attention that people are able to give or they want to give to what they give to charities is limited, isn't it?
Well, it's difficult for them to differentiate one from the other. I was creative director of a very big telephone agency for years.
Mm-hmm.
So I had the, you know, privilege of going to listen into phone calls. And it would be, you know, so I'm literally hearing donors speaking all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It would be funny if it wasn't sad, the amount of times that you would hear someone, say on an upgrade call or a reactivation call,
mm-hmm.
who had no idea they'd been supporting or that they supported you.
Mm.
You know, they just didn't know, or they didn't know, you know, they knew in some way they were supporting a quote unquote charity, but if you asked them to press which charity, they would give you something, you know, I support cancer, I support kids, I support the homeless. They wouldn't be able to then say, I support this particular charity and here are the values that they espouse, because they just didn't know, because this rush that we've all got on acquisition has led to a kind of race to the middle. We're all, you know, everyone's afraid to step outside. Everyone starts to look like the others, and it's very difficult for one charity to tell the difference from another in the donor's eye.
Yeah.
Were the charity to start taking donor service seriously, you know, and to start creating some human interactions, fixing a problem in the moment, you know, let's say there's a problem making an online donation.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
What about a little pop-up that just asks, how can we fix that for you?
Which is
how
happening. Well, personally, I've seen this once in the charity sector, but I mean, in commercial terms, this is very few websites now where you don't go on there. Who do you want to talk to?
Yeah. And if you could do that, I mean, we've seen things like a 3x lift. You know, the charities that are doing it are seeing a 3x lift in cross-sell and upsell. You know,
mm-hmm.
just by offering that, you know, that interaction.
Did you know that we also... Yeah,
just fixing it. I've seen charities that just by making donor services available, you know, so most charities will bury donor services phone number way down at the bottom of the website in tiny, tiny small print.
Donor services me.
So if you want to ring up and, you know, ask something, you know, you got my name wrong, or I'd like to find out about such and such, you know. Okay. That number's buried. It's very bit. It's hard to get in touch with us, you know. But we've done work with a lot of charities now and shown that if you just by turning up the volume on that, just by making yourself available, making the phone number bigger and people can see it, retention will improve 20%. Even if you do nothing, if you make yourself available for a complaint, but do nothing about the complaint, retention still improves by 20%. If you actually fix the thing very quickly, you know, they ring up and say, you know, you spelled my name wrong, you know, whatever it might be, whatever kind of thing people are ringing in. If you fix that, they've seen retention rates go knocking nearly 100%.
Really?
Literally.
So the simple fact of the person, the supporter, being aware of their ability to get in touch has a difference.
It makes a massive difference because you suddenly become human. You suddenly, there's a chance for, it's a bit of a MC phrase, but you know, the chance to surprise and delight that person. Mm-hmm. You actually get to stand out.
And that's interesting because, and also about the sort of level of detail that charities think of themselves in, what we were just talking about, and then what the supporter's thinking about. So they're seeing sectors, charities, no, chapter and verse, obviously, on their organisation, their brand, what they stand for, the cause. So there's that mismatch in detail, isn't there? And also from what you're saying, it makes me think that that's kind of about the organisation being a bit inward looking. And, you know, if you go on this, the standard doesn't exist, but if you go on a charity's website, there'll be a lot of stuff about, again, the cause, the work, you know, lots and lots of detail. But actually, is that supporter experience what they want internalized into that? And from what you've said, it's probably not happening at this point. Right? And that's carried over into the sort of ways that people, potential supporters, are identified, isn't it? So we use sort of standard techniques of kind of recency and frequency of value and that kind of thing. But that's sort of linked in a way to what you were talking about, because you set your direct debit up and it goes out every month. Yeah. You could easily forget about that. It's not an active way to support.
No, it's not. And it's I think committed giving, using that as a phrase, is a really misleading. I think it's a comforting, it's very comforting for us. But I mean, again, going back to my telephone fundraising days, it would be, so many charities were reluctant to call their quote-unquote committed givers for fear of reminding them they were giving. So how committed would they be? You know, we did some work for, pretty much the McDonald's of UK charities. I mean, incredibly well known. And they had one of these, like everyone's doing at the moment, the current best practice around retention, and I think we should talk about this a bit later on because it doesn't work. But the current best practice is all about, we need to be sending them thank yous. Just thank you, thank you, thank you. Okay. So this charity was doing that and retention had got worse. You know, not directly as a result of that, but just when the retention problem, they brought this thank you program in, the retention problem got even worse.
Right.
But they had, by accident, a control group, which they basically just, a group of people that they'd lost on the file somewhere, who were do not contact. And those people would have double lifetime value. You know, their lifetime value was double just from the fact that the charity left them alone.
I mean, it's telling, isn't it?
Yeah.
So just, yeah, by asking less than that. Are there any other sort of insights about sort of frequency and that kind of thing? Does Donor Voices research point to that fact that charities need to be quite restrained, really, in how they're communicating?
We haven't seen, working with a lot of different charities, any, I think best practices is a bit of a myth. I mean, I will say around the recency frequency value, or recency frequency monetary value, depends which side of the Atlantic you're on, but how you use that. But it's an incomplete picture at best. You know, to take that as a barometer for loyalty is, if you think about it, you're saying, if it was an equation, you'd be saying transactional variables equals a good donor. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The trouble with that is both sides of that equal sign are outcomes. Mm-hmm. It's all effect. There's no cause. It's saying a good donor is a good donor because they're a good donor. Oh. You know. So what do you get to do with that information? What strategy does that leave you with, other than we need to pump enough stuff as we possibly can out through enough channels in the hope that enough people will raise their hands, which leads to this enormous volume game, you know, just chuck it all out there, and hopefully enough of these people will raise their hand and say yes. It's kind of, it would never be said this way, but it's kind of based on the idea that loyalty is somehow an inherent quality that just exists, and our job is to go and find it. You know, a good donor is someone who is, they're born a good donor. So yeah. Our job is to kind of get the net out, trawl down the high streets, you know, and find these people, and the bad ones will slip through, but the good ones will stick in there. Yeah. You know, and it's nonsense. I mean, the reality, the recency, frequency, value, it tells you what they did, is never going to tell you what they'll do.
Yeah.
You know, and you can get incredibly sophisticated with all kinds of segmentation models, you can append lifestyle data to it, you know, like mosaics or whatever else, and start to get all these little cluster groups and subgroups. And you can torch that information, you know, so much. You know, you'll find things like we can find of our last, let's say our last upgrade campaign, I don't know if I'm just making these figures up, but our last upgrade campaign, we can see that 36% of people said no. And of that 36%, we can see 54% of those were men. And, you know, and then we could actually see that of that 54%, 26% said no on a Tuesday. And of that 26%, 12% of them also go to the gym on a Tuesday. And of that 12%, 16% wear Nike trainers. And of those 16%, you know, 19% have got a moustache and so on. I mean, at what point does it become, I mean, what the hell do you do with that? I mean, you can't do anything with it.
You can use it if you want to, but a great man once said, it's better to be roughly right than exactly wrong. And what we're in the situation, from what you've said, is of being very, very exactly right about something, but it's in completely the wrong area.
Right. You can't, but you're not going to put a strategy in. You could try, but I mean, it would become incredibly, you know, how are you going to resource that, though? Because it's not going to happen. Yeah. What we're saying is, what they did is half the picture. You know, it will. Seeing what they did will never tell you the why that they did it. The trouble, correlation is not causation. So all those things about the gym class, the night trainers, the moustache, those won't, you know, they correlate. Yeah. None of those things are in any way causal they did it.
But it's extraordinary that is the case, because this is like, you do GCSE statistics or something like this, and then that's the first thing you say, you know? And there's all, you know, there's famous examples about the sales of ice cream goes up in summer, but murder rates go up in summer as well, right? So ice cream must cause murder.
That's
not that one. Yeah. Right, but that's exactly what you're talking about. Chase, please find out for the ice cream.
For the police.
But this,
Mr. Whippy would be behind bars.
But this is exactly what you're talking about, right? Yeah. So correlation is not causation, but it's being seen as such. So can we just talk a little bit then about sort of methods and methodologies? And we mentioned lifetime value, and what are there a sort of few tools that we can start to move to?
Well, the thing we have to do is we have to bring the RFV, RFM to life. It's not unimportant. It's just only half the picture. You know, what we need to do is to drill down the why. You know, how the best to describe it. If you visualize on the right hand side is the behavior. It's the thing you want. It's the giving or it's the doing. Okay. Mm-hmm. On the left hand side, you've got the experiences that we generate to try and cause that. So everything. This is transcends fundraising. There's fundraising, but brand, donor services, comms, everything, the charity. You know, the donors don't experience us in the silos that we sit in, you know. They just see Oxfam, Cancer Research, St. George, whatever. So you've got all the things that we do to try and cause that behavior. The reality is nobody directly causes behavior. You know, there's nothing I can do to make you do anything, you know. But the way you think and feel about me will determine how you act towards me. That, the think and feel part, is 100% under our control. You know, ultimately, the way they think and feel about us will be determined by their reaction to the stuff that we send them. Okay? Now, the code for measuring thought and feeling has been cracked. That's part of the work that Roger and Kevin did, but they're not, you know, pioneering that. They've drawn from relationship theory, which you can Google white papers on this going back years. It's the same stuff that Adrian Seidman is drawing from and so on. You know, the answer to most of our problems was cracked by academia 50, 70, 100 years ago, because no one could understand what they were talking about. Relationship theory is the part. So there are three component parts to this. So you could break down how a relationship exist and measure it. And this is a relationship, the same relationship you have with a friend, a colleague, a loved one, a brand, a charity. And the first step of that is the ability to deliver a functional connection. Now, functional means, is the experience that I'm delivering reliable and consistent? So you step into Starbucks or Pret a Manger, doesn't matter where you are, we're an Angel now, but if it was an old street, Liverpool Street, you know, or the high street in Glasgow or Manchester or Birmingham, it would always be Starbucks, it would always be Pret a Manger. No one is walking in there, they're not thrown by the experience. You know, they know what to expect, they know the service quality, they know the pricing, they know the kind of, you know, the
quality. Yeah. Well.
They know what they're going to get from there. And you survey 100 people walking out of any of these places and say, what is that all about? You get a very consistent answer. You know, you now think about taking 100 donors off any house file and sitting there for anything between 6 months and 3 years and ask them the same question, what is this charity all about? The chances that we would get the same consistency of answer would be slim to non-existent. So, you know, that's the first. We need to be able to measure a functional connection. And Donor Voice, you know, I don't know if I could put a link at the bottom of this or something, but I mean, you can, there are, I'll make this available for all the listeners. There are three questions you ask, and you measure that. Okay, so that can be done. If you get the functional connection correct, you move to the second step. Like any relationship, it evolves, you know, the difference between a first date and then, you know, getting more committed. The second step of that relationship is the ability to form a personal connection. And this is exactly what it sounds like, the idea that there's reciprocity, you know, that I'm not just donor number 746241 on your file, that, you know, that you understand, you care, you speak to who I want to be or how I want to be seen, you know, the kind of moral and social identity bit. And again, you can measure that. Now, if you get a functional connection and you get a personal connection, those are the component parts that then form commitment, which is, you know, another word for loyalty. You know?
Yes.
Now, that commitment, unlike RFM, which tells you what they did, is by far and away the best predictor of what they will do. You know, and again, this is not some just wacky theory, this has been tested and validated and proven. You know, you look at any of the different things that are out there at the moment, net promoter score, satisfaction, so on, any of these things that are kind of out there that are being used as predictors of future behaviour, commitment smashes them all. You know, I mean, and again, there was some work, and this is a paper that Kevin wrote with Adrian a little while back, the difference between a net promoter score, the difference someone with a high or low propensity on that, there was a 5% variable. You know,
it was really
someone with a high and low commitment in the UK specifically, 105% variable.
Yeah.
You know? So being able to get into the measuring and managing of that, there is enormous value. And we're talking about hundreds of thousands, millions of pounds that we're leaving on the table because we're having an incomplete picture. We have the what they did, but we're missing the why they did it. Okay.
Right.
So that can be measured and it can be managed.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I'm thinking two things, really. The first is what actually... I mean, this will be a significant change. If charities were to move in this sort of direction, it would mean adopting lots of new kind of ways of measuring things. But in your mind, do you think it would be...
It wouldn't even be lots of new. It would be adding a bit. We're missing a bit. That's why when you get right down to it, we have most of what we need.
Mm-hmm.
We're missing the bit. You know, it's like when you get your jigsaw puzzle, it's like that last bit is just not there, so it's not going to work.
Right. So is it
all we're missing is attitudinal data? That doesn't. There's no proxy for that on the house file anywhere.
Right.
If you add the attitudinal data, which is literally just the question of going out and getting it and being able to have the right methodology to do that.
Yeah.
If you were to get that and add that, you can suddenly, let's say, you know, you look at all of the experiences you generate across brand, fundraising, donor services, events, etc., etc., etc. Okay. And you do commitment scoring for people, so you find out their commitment score. You then ask them to rate all of those experiences. Any charity, you can broadly, very comfortably say, will probably have around 40, 60, 80, quote-unquote, experiences that they're delivering, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's not a huge leap of faith to say some of those matter more than others, you know?
Yeah.
But
they will to certain groups, certain people will have more.
Exactly. So depending on how these people are grouped by the charity, but let's just take, just for the ease of, you know, demonstration now, let's take this one group who are exposed to this 60, 70 different things, okay? Not all of those experiences are going to matter. but it's very difficult for a charity to know beyond things that have a specific financial metric tied to them, which are which. You know, you can obviously say campaign A outperformed campaign B. It's easy. You look at the numbers and you go, that beat that. What you'll never be able to do is say, how did campaign A affect the way people felt about campaign B?
Okay. Yeah.
And when you think about the response rate to the non-response rate,
yeah.
You know, and tomorrow's, you know, today's non-responder is hopefully tomorrow's responder.
Mm-hmm.
This is important stuff.
Yeah.
But that's in the microcosm of a single campaign run by a single team. You then throw everything else that the organisation does into the mix.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's absolute guesswork.
Mm-hmm.
So, but by adding the attitudinal part to this, you can start to see and actually measure out. You ask these people to score you for each of the experiences you have, every single experience, get a performance rating from them.
Mm-hmm.
Through commitment modelling, you can derive importance. Okay? There's no point asking someone how important something is because they can't tell you. It's just not possible for the human brain to think that way. But you know, through the modelling that Donor Voice is doing, you can derive the importance of it.
Okay?
So you now end up with all of these experiences you deliver and you find out how important they are. Okay? That's half the picture. If that was on its own, that would be an incomplete picture.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side, you've got the how much they gave. That's an incomplete picture.
Mm-hmm.
But when you marry the two, you know, when you overlay the attitudinal with the transactional, now you can suddenly start to correlate, you know, it's very specifically, so let's say the lifetime value was £100 for the sake of easy maths, okay? And you found out that, I don't know, the fact that they have a charity shop on their high street that they regularly visit turned out to be 10% worth of the importance of their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You now know that that experience of going in and out of that charity shop is worth £10 of that lifetime value.
Yeah.
So suddenly you're able to change the way you're looking at the world and make decisions based on fact rather than guesswork.
And so collecting that, non-profit should be looking, charity should be looking to collect this at every opportunity.
Absolutely. I'm assuming.
So every interaction is really, really key, isn't it, with the supporter.
Yeah.
Just say a few words, if you can, about the sort of where this leads us then with the idea of a donor journey, because this is quite a ubiquitous idea for charities, to use the idea that you start somewhere and then a number of things happen along the way. It's a linear sort of journey.
Yeah.
And then there's an end point and we pass through. But this doesn't seem to reflect how people actually experience organisations and charities in the modern world. It doesn't really capture what it's like to have the amount of information. A lot of us have got smartphones. We're out there in the world. There's ads, there's train panels, there's TV ads, there's things coming through the door. So how valuable is that idea at this point, do you think?
What, the donor journey?
Yeah.
Well, it's a bit of, you're on a journey whether you know it or not, I think, but the idea to try and that we can somehow kind of commoditize that, you know, and make this assembly line where people will just fall neatly onto this journey as evidenced by the horrendous retention figures we've got, clearly isn't working, you know. That's not to say that we shouldn't be trying to plot strategy, but we should be plotting the strategy far more smartly than we are currently.
You know?
At the moment, like I was saying earlier, all we've got is the ability to see what they did and bombard them. But were we to know what they wanted, you know, what is the job they're paying us to do? You know, all the things, there's on one side, there's all the things that we want to be.
Mm.
And on the other side, there is the few things that we actually are in their mind.
Mm.
You know, because as much as, you know, we would like to be, you know, whatever, you know, all the different things that are tied to programmatic spend and mission, the reality is, human brain's only going to take in so much, and you know, you're probably going to be defined in the mind of the donor as a few things.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
But that donor never gets it. But back to the functional connection of reliable, consistent experience.
Mm-hmm.
We never talk to the donor about those few things because we don't know what they are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's potluck. So we just bombard them.
Yeah. You know?
Sometimes they get what they want. Most of the time they don't.
Yeah.
You know, so if someone gets acquired with, say, a message about, I don't know, save a life by buying a malaria net. You know, they then get the welcome call that tells them, that thanks them for their work helping orphans of HIV/AIDS. And then, you know, when they it comes to their reactivation call, it's, you know, thanking them again for their work trying to stop tax dodging governments. You know, and it's like, well, yeah, is it any wonder this poor soul is confused where their £3 went? You know, it's just like, what's going on?
And I mean, people the donors typically support two or three charities, right?
You know,
so there'll be people out there. So and that, in my mind, that just really throws a complete spanner in the works, because that's one donor journey across maybe an appeal, maybe a couple of appeals, something like that. This doesn't even take in what the whole organisation is doing, let alone could never really capture what's going on outside. Yeah. So it doesn't really catch what's
important. But it's about, and I guess back to the startups or the present monitoring principle, it's about if you deliver the value, you'll derive the value. If you knew what your donors wanted from you, you know, and this is not to the extent of compromising mission. I mean, if you, obviously, if you knew what they wanted from you, and you could give it to them, they stick around longer. People, the trouble we've got when we think about retention is we think of retention as something else to do. You know, so we have all the different departments. You know, it's the way we label ourselves. We have the acquisition team, and then we have the retention team. And, there's this complete disconnect. Retention isn't something that we do. It's the byproduct of everything that we do. We need to get a handle on that everything. And if we could bundle that up and understood what mattered and what didn't, you could put a strategy together based on that. We need to deliver that. We get better value. You know, so this is ultimately about improving performance. If I can give the donor what they want tomorrow, they're going to give me what I want tomorrow. If they've got what they want tomorrow, the chances are they'll be there the day after tomorrow, and the day after, and so on. It's about consistently delivering what they, what they're looking for over time. So lo and behold, your immediate campaign metrics go up. I mean, the charities who are doing this now, who've kind of gone through the commitment modeling bit and have uncovered what their client donors actually want, and have put together a strategy based on that, and making sure that every communication talks about that, has seen radical improvements. I mean, just the other day, someone is reporting back, just on a straight A-B campaign test, doubled net revenue. Just because it's good, which is not shocking. Give them what they want, they'll give you what you want. And if you do that, they'll stick around. If you don't do that, why on earth would they?
So this is, I mean, this is achievable stuff, really.
Achievable, what's happening.
Yeah. So we've talked about quite a lot of things there. Are there any other, because a lot of the people sort of listening will be from a kind of quant background, if I can put it like that. So lifetime value is really important to measure, isn't it? That's a real key measure. Do you think that, should we be looking then to one measure in particular to do the job that we're talking about, to be a measure of, let's say, commitment? Or do we need a kind of mixture of different, like a toolbox kind of approach, so we've got a few different things that are key measures that we do report on to look at commitment? Do you think that's how we should be approaching it?
Well, lifetime value should be moved to being the ultimate metric we focus on. I mean, and aside from it being just from a business point of view, the smart move, it's also from a mission point of view, the ethical thing to do. Any organisation out there can honestly say that they will achieve their mission in the space that they want to see ROI on this campaign, that we'll find the cure, we'll right the wrong, we'll feed every child, then not making lifetime value the ultimate metric is just unethical.
Interesting. But we will, and in terms of actually measuring that then, because a lot of this is going to come back to the information that we're actually capturing, what would this actually concretely look like for charities to do? Is this just more surveys, or is it?
No, it's the survey part is simply there to capture attitudinal data that is nowhere on the CRM. If anywhere on the CRM you have the attitudinal data you need to complete the picture, you'd never need to do the survey. Once you've done it, the world doesn't change that radically. You don't need to be surveying people every week, every month to find out. The world is not going to change that much, unless you suddenly introduce something radically new. The world is going to be as it is. It then becomes about uncovering what matters and delivering it. To put it as crudely as that, uncover what they need, give it to them, and they'll give you what you need. So lifetime value is important, but you'll start to, and crucial, but you'll start to see the short-term, immediate financial wins every charity is looking for.
And what the barrier, in terms of the barriers that are actually stopping this being achieved, because a lot of what we've talked about, it sounds eminently doable, right? So collectively, this is not something that will take, based on solid evidence, it shouldn't take huge amounts of time once we've identified the value, and you know, there's a lot of evidence out
there. The irony is it actually takes less, because we are incredibly busy and not very productive. You know, so for example, clients we're working with at the moment, once you know what they want, you've created everything you'll need for that year within about 90 days.
Yeah.
Because you don't need, I was a creative director for years, we don't need to spend so much time in these endless meetings, kind of innovating, blue sky, and coming up, just guessing, basically.
Yeah.
You know, once you know what they want, we need to get into the boring business. You know, we get bored what we produce far quicker than our donors do. You know, and the idea that once we've said the message once, everyone's heard about it, is, and we know what our response rate is. I mean, we're contradicting ourselves anyway. We need to be consistently delivering key messages that we know matter over time.
And that's key, isn't it? Keeping on, not just saying it once or twice, but keeping on.
Yeah, just keep saying it, because that's what, it's what we are to them, you know? So that's what we need to be giving them.
Yeah.
You know? But the barriers we're talking about, I mean, ultimately, this doesn't come down to, this is easy to do because we're already doing it. You know, in terms of fundraising is not going to stop. So it's not as though the fundraising train ever stops rolling. Every single charity, everyone who's listening now, every single charity around the world is spending huge amounts of time, money and effort trying to get people to do and to do more. So they're always doing it. This is about addition by subtraction. You know, good strategy is about as much about what we're not going to do as what we are going to do. It's about forcing a choice. It's about discovering what should we be focusing on so we can eliminate what we're not. I mean, a great example, just as this is another, you know, this is from a client a little while back. You look at all the experiences you're delivering and you find out which matter or don't. Now, this was someone had their magazine, okay? Every organization has the debate year in, year out, do we keep it, do we get rid of it? You know, you've got the fundraising team saying, you know, you can't, in most fundraising, most organizations have a magazine. Most magazines make a financial ask and most magazines make a financial loss. Typically, I mean, some don't, and on the whole, most do. So every year, there's the big debate, do we keep it, do we get rid of it? The fundraisers say, no, we've got to keep it, you know, we can't say that we can't prove it, but we know that kind of on some
nebulous level,
it's adding value, people like it, and then you've got, you know, the CFO, whoever it is, saying it's a red number on the ledger, get rid of it, just get shot at it.
Yeah.
You can't know. The point is, it ultimately comes down to subjective, and the kind of the loudest voice or the biggest title wins. But it's never based on anything that's empirical or solid. So in this particular example, I found out that magazine, don't need the magazine, it's not helping. And this is not a reflection. I mean, as many times we found it didn't matter, we found that it does. So this is not a comment on magazines, you know.
Right.
The point is, do you know whether yours does or not?
Right.
So in this case, it didn't matter. So straight away, that's £150,000 a year they could better spend elsewhere, you know. So the decision was made, let's drop it. We can now see that it's not adding any value. You know, it's not in any way causing a functional connection or a personal connection. So it's not driving loyalty, so it's not causing behavior. So why are we spending all this time, money and effort on it? When there were plenty of other things. In this case, they found out that their e-newsletter was working, you know, that added value, and I forget the exact financial it was worth, but they could see, although that e-newsletter had no financial ask attached to it, you could see that the percentage of value was important to them, you looked at you added the attitude of the transactional data. So the next thing becomes, well, if that, they like it and it's a winner, why don't we scale it? You know, again, deliver greater value, derive greater
value.
This
is evidence-based fundraising.
Evidence-based, yeah. Well, this is, if you were to summarise this in a nutshell, it's all this woolly talk that we've had for years about donor-centric and donor journeys and emotion and all this, and it's all perfect, really great stuff that we should be doing, but we've never been able to do anything more than kind of what should be common sense basic technique around, you know, we use the word you rather than us and that kind of stuff. We've never been able to take it any further than that, really.
Yeah.
This is about actually empirically uncovering what is that donor's relationship with you all about. You know, what is that donor's relationship with you all about? And if you knew that, there'd be a hell of a lot of the things you're doing at the moment that you didn't need to do.
Yeah.
There'd be a hell of a lot of things that you're doing at the moment that you should be doing more of. There'd be an awful lot of things on that list that matter, but you're not doing a good job of, so you need to fix them.
But that's what you said before in my mind, that's the definition of strategy. So you said about what not to do.
Yeah.
And I think that's the best for me. That's the best definition. But then the organisation has to get behind that.
Absolutely.
Right? So yeah. The evidence, I agree with everything you just said. So evidence-based, every step of the way, identifying gaps, designing products, and then scaling or dropping or what have you. Yeah. But the whole organisation needs to be behind this, doesn't
it? Yeah, the decision, and this is something else that was uncovered in the work that Roger and Ken did. The at best, the decision to stay or go, you could account for about 25% of that falling in the fundraising team. You know, the donor or the supporter doesn't look at you in terms of fundraising, brand, comms, you know, etc. You know, they just see the organisation.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Exactly.
So you know, it's about the totality of the experiences. Again, retention is not something we do; it's everything that we do. Mm. You know, mm-hmm. And until we understand that everything and how much it matters or it doesn't, we're just grabbing at straws. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So this idea that somehow we just add a retention team. You know, it's naive. It's and plus, you know, show me the charity that's turning up at the benchmarking team meeting and saying, here's what we've done, here's our great results. You know, we're coming to the end of the year now, so I don't know when this is going out, but I mean, we're December 2014, you know. Who's seen any massive significant increase on 2013 or 2012 or 2011? You know, who's expecting to see any great lift in 2015? You know, that great fundraising report that Adrian Sargent did, you know, where they uncovered in a lot of organisations the culture that it was acceptable not to hit target. You know, that it becomes so used to not hitting target that it's acceptable not to hit target.
So a variation, so just similar to last year.
Well, yeah, because the pressure comes down from on high that you've got to hit last year's number. You know, you've got to hit last year's number. What's the easiest way to hit last year's number? Do what you did last year. Mm. You know, doesn't matter how, you know, and this is where, you know, it's kind of a vicious circle between charities demanding that and agencies, you know, being complicit in it. Mm-hmm. You know, recycling a lot of ideas. You know, so you know, without someone actually saying no, that won't work.
But how can then, given all that, how can people doing sort of similar jobs to what I do and what people working in Insight will be working in? How can we use evidence and data and understanding to get that message across? Because it strikes me that
internally
in the organisations, So I think there's something about people working in Insight or what have you, having a communication skill set as well. So not just being an analytical person, but also sort of doing this communication stuff. What's the message to get across then? What's the best way to get across the message that actually, if we're just measuring, you know, recency, frequency, value, you know, that type of thing, actually it's not going to do the job and we need to branch out?
I don't know if I'm oversimplifying this here, but what was that Einstein quote, that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing expecting a different result?
Yeah, that's right.
You know? Now, I mean, the trouble is, we don't think we're doing the same thing, because as much as we're just dusting off last year's strategy, we're throwing in all these, you know, tests and ideas and innovations and what have you, but there's no empirical basis for them. They're all reactive, they're all after the fact.
Yeah.
You know, they're not grounded in anything solid. Nothing ever changes. So the best way to get the message across is quite easy. Again, I don't want to sound oversimplistic, show them the money.
Right.
Show them the money. There is huge amounts of money to be made just by, you know, unlocking the value that already sits on your database. You know, none of this is science fiction, it's fact. Mm. You know, there are charities now who are doing this, you know, they're the minority, you know, but it's that, I don't know if you're familiar with the diffusion of innovation curve.
Ideas
catch on, so I think it's the early adapters, the first 15%. So those charities are out there now.
Yeah.
You're doing this.
Yeah, you know? So that's where it is on that journey, because it's a steep slope, isn't it?
And then you get the late arrivals and so on. So there are charities that are out there that are doing it, you know, who are seeing product purchase treble, who are seeing attrition down by 50%, profit up by 35%. I mean, it's staggering numbers.
It's really transformational change.
Which is achieving the thing that the sector is desperate for, which is growth. Because we're not growing.
Yeah, and that goes back to what we were talking about before, that we're sort of looking to grow our individual slice of the pie, but actually the bigger challenge, which is truly truly huge, actually, is to actually reach out to new audiences and actually build those relationships.
New audiences, but it's also the audiences that you've got that were you to, if you knew what they cared about, they'd give you more money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really similar. I'll probably repeat this a lot, but at the age of oversimplifying it, give them what they want, they'll give you more of what you want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that the individual giving is the same amount of money as cheese is damning to us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's absolutely damning. You know, do we seriously think that the public, that is their level of empathy, that is their level of compassion, that is their level of concern about these issues, mm-hmm. or is it that we don't warrant anymore
mm-hmm.
because they don't understand what they will get from us?
And it's not actually about them; it's about the organisation.
There was that study, I think Bloomerang did it, where they mm-hmm. showed that the reason why people left charities, stopped giving to charities, rather than why they stopped giving to the commercial organisation. And on the charity side, there was 36% of people who stop donating never stop donating to the cause, they just stop donating to that particular charity.
Mm.
And then give to another one because they honestly couldn't tell the difference. You know, there's the naivety to think that donors do not have choice, you know? That every organisation is great and every organisation has, you know, reasons to exist, you know? But it's very hard for donors to tell what they are.
What the actual difference is.
Yeah. And that's not because donors are dumb, it's because we're not making it clear.
Yeah. But to get onto that journey where we start moving towards retaining, building relationships, changing what we measure, changing structures in some cases, that will be the case. That's going to have to be out of the sort of comfort zone of charities, isn't it? We're going to have to sort of make some...
Yeah, but then again, it's like, how do you define risk? I mean, at the moment, if we're losing more donors than we're getting, you know, what's the risk if we carry on doing that? How long as a business model is that sustainable? Where in a commercial world, you know, would you have anyone who would walk into the boardroom and say, we're losing 7 out of 10 customers, my plan is we'll carry on doing the same thing? You know, you would be thrown out the window.
Mm.
You know, is that what are we risking by not changing it? You know, we're not talking about taking a gamble here. We're saying, you know, commercials don't lose their customers. They just don't. You know, people lose it, but they're not losing them in any way near the astronomical numbers we are.
Yeah.
What are they doing that we're not? You know, everything that we've talked about now has been going on in the commercial world 10, sometimes 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just taking us such a long, long time to catch up.
Yeah, boring that practice. And I think that's, I really take that point about strategy because there's, I mean, this is a ubiquitous word, really. Like, it's absolutely everywhere, but it's kind of not that well understood, it seems to me, because it's more about actually being really ruthlessly honest about what you're not going to do.
Yeah.
And actually just being like, right, if that's not going to meet the bar that we're setting for ourselves, then sorry, we can't do it.
Yeah, and again, this is never to the detriment of mission or anything else, but it's about having being ruthlessly pragmatic about what is it these people want from us? Because that's where the money is going to come from. Right. And if we actually want to achieve this mission, we're going to have to pay for it somehow.
Yeah.
There's other things we're going to have to do in terms of what our responsibility here, us as fundraisers, we're here to raise the money. If we want to raise the money, that's how we're going to do it. You know, this naivety that somehow if we just, you know, throw everything at them, or people want to be educated, you know, or they wanted to be taken on a journey.
Mm-hmm.
They just want to be told the truth. They don't want to be patronised.
So where does this all lead? Where is this leading in the future, do you think? So do you think retention is the sort of coming idea for UK fundraising sector? Do you see it sort of spreading?
I think more people are getting the idea. People are getting the idea that, you know, attrition bad, retention good.
Mm.
You know, which is like, that's a step forward. But I think people will still struggle to define what they meant by retention. I think we touched on it earlier, the idea that now, well, let's add a retention team, let's add a retention department, let's do some retention work. It's like, well, what would that look like?
Yeah.
So the reality is that, you know, you've got at the moment the best practice that has got zero evidence to show it's working is retention has become completely synonymous with, if we just say thank you, if we just send them some communication, phone call, letter, mobile, text, whatever it might be, it's got no ask, we just say thank you, that's retention and it will work. You know, there's no evidence. Any please contradict me if anyone has got any, but it would be funny if it wasn't tragic. And, you know, the people who are hiring us to come and do this, you know, are the ones who tried and badly failed.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The amount of time I've seen people who've spent a huge amount of money on that, you know, only to see retention get worse.
You know? Yeah, because it's not a rounded, rounded experience.
Well, it's not, and it, again, it fundamentally undermines the thing that it was there to do. So this is this concept that a relationship is rooted in a functional connection, that I need to deliver a reliable, consistent experience. You've suddenly added, from all the different teams who are communicating with this poor donor, giving them load of mixed messages, the retention team throwing in something else. So it's not as though thank you is wrong. I mean, thank you is the most important word in any fundraiser's vocabulary, but it has to be relevant and it has to be tied to what the hell they think you do in the first place. Yeah. Otherwise, you're just confusing these people.
Yeah, because it's just more. And this is, I mean, this is a hallmark of a, I mean, you read sort of business books, and one of the hallmarks of organisations when they're failing, or initiatives when they're failing, is to do more.
Yeah.
Like, we need to just do
more. Yeah, ramp up the volume. I mean, ramp up the volume. Yeah. That's all we're doing. I mean, and it is, it's this thank you thing is also, it's predicated on a false assumption that somehow donors have created these mental categories where they see the difference between ask and no ask. You know, when that thank you letter lands on the map, somehow their X-ray vision is able to determine there's no asking here, therefore I will open it and feel good.
Well,
you know,
yeah.
Or when the fundraiser rings up to say, hello, I'm calling from, I just want to thank you, as though they can, you know, they feel that an ask is coming any minute now. If you've ever had some of these calls, they're uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if you were at the annual lectures last year, but it was funny when someone was playing one, you know, doing this great talk about thank you, you've got to be saying thank you. And they played this thank you call, which is excruciatingly uncomfortable.
What were they?
Well, it was just the person on the end of the phone. You could just feel the resistance.
It's scripted and it's.
Well, it's scripted, and you know that's not the poor fundraiser's fault. I mean, the fundraiser does the best job with what they're given, and they're usually not given very much. That's a whole other conversation, but. You know, the person there on the line is waiting for the other shoe to drop. They're waiting for that moment to come. You know, but at the end of listening to this example, and it was like complete silence. Someone put their hand up and asked genuinely, "Was that a good or a bad example?" You know, like they couldn't tell. You know, and this is the best that we've come up with as a best practice.
Yeah, and it's not. I mean, it strikes me that there's. I think fundraising quite often is about distance and just removing the distance between the supporter and the work. And that having that reaction come across, right? Yeah. So some of the best, one of the most memorable fundraising events I've ever been to was in a theatre where the researcher had just come back from Zimbabwe and was based out there and was talking about their experience around sort of Mugabe living under the regime there. Literally one person on a stage talking. That was it. Spotlight, packed house, absolutely gripped, right? These people, that will be hugely memorable for them because it almost kind of transports them, you know, that's a direct connection with the work, and that would be incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
But what you've just talked about is, you know, there's the work over here, there's the supporter over here, and in between that, there are many, many levels of departments and agencies.
But also, in your example, the people had opted in to go to that thing.
True.
This is us going out to them that you will be thanked.
That's true.
You
know, but
you will be grateful for it.
I've worked on telephone campaigns myself with sort of alumni of a university, which is a kind of, you know, can be a more or less tenuous link. But even where there's a constituency where there is some perceived vested interest, then it's still, you're still nowhere near the actual work.
Yeah, right?
That connection isn't massively strong. So, yeah.
That's why the service is important. People never. By definition, from the work we do, it's very difficult to bring people towards a fundraiser.
Yeah, that's true.
Just as an idea of work, the best proxy they take is the service. You know, I've no idea how my £10 is being used out in the field, you know, to provide vaccination or food. But you know, if I get a good level of service from you, I kind of feel more comfortable that maybe you're doing a good job with that.
Yeah.
So how do we take that service to another level? How do we take the page from the commercial book and start to actually get info? The only information we're set up to care about is transactional data after the fact. You know, if we could, after each donation, you know, just a quick bounce back, you know, did you get what you're looking for? You know, tie it to the commitment question so you can start to see where people are, you know, in relation to you. How good a job did we do? Was it important or not? And start to form a quadrant of, you know, the things that need to be resolved, things that need to be resolved now, and so on. You know, it's a whole other mindset of doing this. But where you to do that, you see radical improvements in retention and performance because suddenly you've stood out in the mind of a donor in a way that nobody else is doing.
Yeah, and there's some real first mover advantage there, isn't there?
Yeah.
And again,
some are doing it with staggering results.
Mm. Right, I'm aware of time a little bit because we've covered a huge amount, really sort of big areas. I think in just washing up, would you just be able to say, if you were to sort of summarise shopping list of actions for charities to do to build their ability to retain supporters and build that connection in two, three, 4 points, just really sort of pithy stuff.
I think there's four barriers that we have that stop us ever addressing the root cause of churn. Okay, so the first one is thinking that churn can be addressed, after the fact. So the reinstatement program, the reactivation, or in the minority of people who call in to say I'm going to cancel. By the way, doing it that way is always by definition after the fact.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's where we go.
Right.
We've got to stop believing that this no ask thing, is the silver bullet, because there's no evidence for it.
Right.
There's plenty of evidence to show it isn't working. There's none to show it is. Very large print. Thank you, radically important, but think about what you're saying thank you for.
Right.
We've got to stop looking at only transactional data, because it's only ever going to tell you what they did. Torture it however much you want, it will never answer the why question.
Mm-hmm.
So until we start collecting attitudinal data, we're fundamentally missing a piece.
Mm-hmm.
And the last piece is stop looking at donor services as a cost centre.
Mm.
Start thinking of them as a massive profit centre.
Mm. And language, I think that's really useful, and that will be useful for people listening. I think speaking the language of investment is really important, right?
Mm.
So we talk about costs and profit, but actually, a cost, you're investing in the service, isn't this? It's the way you think about what you're actually spending, I guess, in that example. So I think that's really useful. I think we've covered absolutely loads. I think people will find it really, really useful to listen to that, actually. So it's been great to talk to you. And I just wanted to... Is there anything finally to touch on that we've missed, or any other sort of points that you wanted to...
I hope that's useful. I hope we can start to think differently about retention in 2015. I think we need to just stop thinking it but as something we do later. Retention starts the second they say yes at acquisition.
Mm.
We need to start thinking about the totality of the things that we do. We need to start, I would like to see more organisations appointing someone, I don't know how you target, maybe the chief donor officer, who looks at the totality of the experiences and maps and plans that based on a deep understanding of what that donor wants, not a deep need of what they want from the donor, but knowing what the donor wants from them, and making sure that every communication across department, across channel, is consistent, is delivering that. If we consistently deliver what they're looking for over time, not only does performance and value radically shoot up, retention becomes a natural byproduct. We would stop thinking in terms of retention because it would just be something that happened automatically.
Yeah.
At the moment, god awful attrition is happening automatically and has been doing for years and years and years and years and years.
Mm.
And we're still doing the same thing, expecting a different result. That's got to change.
We need to move towards sanity. That's what we need to do.
I think that's
a great note to end on.
That's a good message for the new year.
Christmas parties, etc.
Yeah.
Thank you again. I really appreciate taking time. And we've covered loads. And hope everyone's enjoyed that. And thanks again, Charlie. Great stuff.
Thank you.